Here we go. All right. Maybe. Well, here I go anyway. So you can come along with me if you want. But here I go. Hi. All right. Is this the craziest week of the year or is that next week? Toss up. Okay. We have two more classes. We have about 4 or 5 hours worth of stuff that I think is absolutely essential to talk about, so we'll pick and choose. Let's see, where are we? The important stuff. Thank you, I recovered reasonably quickly. Just Thursday was a total loss, Friday was a loss. Spent Friday and Saturday with my mother in the hospital. I'm catching up. I'm back. She's much better. Thank you. And, these are the exercises from last Wednesday, very carefully arranged in alphabetical order, you'll notice. And these are old exams and the first exam analyses if you didn't pick yours up. The second exam analyses will be back as soon as Talia manages to finish recording the grades. And before that exercise and before the exam analysis, the total points at the moment in the course look like that. And the average is 106.3 or 4, I've forgotten. Anyway, irrelevant. So, as I said last week, if you're 106 plus, you're fine, just keep doing what you're doing. If you're below that and want to do better, do better. I'm sorry? 106 would be a low B. That was easy. Okay, where are we? Well, the final exam is a week from today. Just think, 1 week from this moment, this course will be over for you. We, of course, will have 2 or 3 more days of it. So, put that on your calendar if it's not already there. It's at 11:45. Odd time. And if your last name begins with the letters M through Z, the latter part of the alphabet, you will take the exam in the Campus Center Theater, the big one. Everybody else will come here. So put that in your calendar too, so you'll remember where you're going, and take a number 2 pencil. Review sessions, carefully considering your input last Wednesday and the available rooms. I have confirmation of these times and places. Wednesday, after class in Fleming 101, the museum downstairs, in that lovely room that I don't like. Friday, 2, Living Learning Commons, Sunday, 3:30. If my notes were correct, that covered the majority of you who wanted them and said you could be available. If you can't come to either the Friday or Sunday one and want one, complain to Talia by email. I'm not sure it'll do any good, but complain anyway, so we'll know. We may be able to do something about that. We won't change these, but she may be willing to add. Okay, questions about that? I will also put that up on the website. I was talking about Eric Erickson. And there were a few little things I wanted to add to flesh out some of my understanding of Erickson with you and some of the usefulness of that, and address particularly the notion that is probably the most persistent of his theory, the thing that he's contributed to modern culture. You know, every theorist who survives long enough gets to give us some notion, and for Erickson that notion is probably the notion of identity crisis in adolescence and midlife crisis in adulthood. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the stage of identity in his theory and elaborate a little bit beyond what is in the text discussion in the chapter on adolescence. So you will remember, perhaps, or you will have put together that Erickson's eight stages begin in infancy with concern with the issues of trust, then in toddlerhood, autonomy and shame, initiative and guilt as people begin to develop a conscience, industry and inferiority as we get into middle childhood and school situations and develop some sense of where we fit with other people, how we compete, how we compare. And then as we move into adolescence, the issue becomes identity, and the contrasting sense is what these authors call confusion. Erickson liked the term diffusion because his notion is that as you move into adolescence, you're challenged to create a sense that all of the various aspects of yourself hang together, that there is a common theme or thread, and that you are consistent. And when we are inconsistent or feel that we're not hanging together, he said the experience that we have is of being diffused. It's not really confused, although we may be that too, but that we don't have a sense that all the parts of our life and all the parts of our values and our thinking hang together and are consistent. So what he was interested in was the metaphor of coherent light, which is all of the same wavelength and travels in a straight path. Diffuse light is spread out across the spectrum and has many wavelengths in it and does not focus, does not go in a straight path, and is therefore different. But when we feel that our life is not hanging together, then we feel that sense of diffusion. That may make us anxious, and that may confuse us, and that's a problem for us. But it's a necessary and normal part of being an adolescent. So the way Erickson describes adolescence is that all of the, this is on the website, don't try to write it down now because I'm going to whip it off there very quickly. Essentially, his point is that as we go through puberty, the body changes, it has completely different potentials, different responses, and we are also acquiring the intellectual skills and reflectiveness that go along with the cognitive changes of adolescence, so that we are forced by our bodies to try to figure out what's happening. We're no longer children, and everybody else is responding differently to us. So that changes the transactions we have with other people, and that can be confusion. Confusing leads to confusion. At the same time as our intellectual skills are developing, we have the ability, the potential, to ask the question, who am I now? How do I put all these different pieces together? And what am I going to be in the future? So he said those two changes usher in this new psychosocial challenge of creating this sense of being a person who is the same across different situations, is the same inside and out, the same in different relationships, and who is consistent in applying his or her values to all aspects of life. That, he said, is what adolescence is about. And it's not an easy task. It's a very challenging task, particularly because adolescence is a time when we're constantly running into new relationships and new situations, so we're having to test whether or not we hang together, whether we can create a sense of identity. So we go through periods, phases, when we feel like life is going along pretty well, and we know who we are. Then we run into some new challenge, new task, a new relationship, and that throws us off balance, and then we have to work to get that sense again as we incorporate the new experience into the identity that we're in the process of creating. And we may go through years of alternating plateaus and feeling like we're doing pretty well, and periods of diffusion. And some of those periods of diffusion may be very anxiety-producing. I mentioned on Wednesday, I believe, that we have it pretty well together as we get through high school, most of us, big seniors, we know where we're going. And then we get to college and it all goes to hell in a handbasket because we're running into all these new demands. We thought we wanted to be a nurse, and then we run into anatomy and physiology, right? And organic chemistry, and the hospital, and the nursing faculty, and that creates diffusion because it's not hanging together the way we thought it ought to. So then we start looking around and decide, oh, maybe I'd rather be an engineer. Maybe I'd rather be a human development and family studies major. Maybe I really like sociology. Just as an aside, it's been really wonderful this weekend. My mother went to the emergency room. She's in the hospital. She's okay. Had VNA nurses at her apartment the last 2 days. The nurse who put the dressing on her injury on Saturday took this course 4 years ago. The VNA nurse who came Sunday was a former student from a number of years ago. And the nurse who came today and taught me how to change the dressing graduated from UVM and took this course about 10 years ago. So it's, Mom loves it because the students come in and they say, I know your son, I took his course. And then I tell her, yeah, and they all got A's. It's fun. Okay, remember isomorphism and non-isomorphism, right? In the cognitive piece. What Erickson is suggesting is that our intellectual skills, he didn't use the term, but this is what he means. Our intellectual skills are giving us the possibility of seeing the non-isomorphism when things don't hang together. And as we go through adolescence with our intellectual skills, in the same way that we wanted our cognitive challenges and tasks to satisfy the principle of isomorphism, he's saying that in our psychosocial life, we want our psychology, our personality, to hang together and to be isomorphic. He wants it to follow the same pattern in every situation, across situations. So he's asking us to put together the fact that we've gone through puberty, right? So we have childhood and we have early adolescence with puberty happening, and then we have middle adolescence and late adolescence. And what happens with the intellectual skills is puberty says to us, okay, you're not the same little kid you were before. How do you make sense out of that change? You don't look the same, you don't feel the same, you don't think the same, you don't want to be the same, you'd like to go back maybe, but you don't want to really be a child again. You're trying to grow up, but you're not yet there. And you're not sure you're going to get there. And besides, when you look at yourself as a chubby, not very socially skilled, pimply, bad hair, out of proportion, early adolescence, you all loved it. You're not sure you want to take that into adulthood if that's the way you're going to be. Are you always going to be confused? So what Erickson says we do is we need to make a single pattern out of our life, past, present, and future. Because now we can think about the hypothetical situations that constitute our future or our possible futures. So we need to make a single scheme out of those, and that will give us a sense of identity. I am the same little kid who remembers going fishing at the lake and catching bluegills without bait on the hook when I was 8. I'm the same kid, but I've gone through these changes, and now I'm going to become an adult, but that's going to take a while. But I'll still be that same person. It's that sense of sameness across time that he means by identity. I am the same. His sameness. Across time, across different situations, I'm the same person. Across my different relationships, with different people, inside and out. I've learned to fake it. I've learned that I have feelings inside that I don't express very well. But I would like to be consistent. I would like people to know who I am. Remember intimacy from Sullivan? I would like people to know me, and that if a person knows me and I know that person and we share a relationship in which we can talk about what's inside, then we can create the isomorphism of being the same inside and out, at least with this one person in this intimate relationship. So with my very, very good friends, I create a sense of identity because they know me inside and out, and they accept me. And they see me pretty much as I see myself. If other people see me as I see myself, that contributes to a sense of identity. I am the same person they're talking about. It is a problem for adolescents when other people don't see us, we, them, the same way they see themselves. So adolescents have antennae that are very alert to how people see them. They're looking for feedback. They want to know how it is that other people perceive them, because they need to compare that to how they perceive themselves, their self-concept. And they want those to be the same. So when you get validation, confirmation of who you are from other people, that makes you feel good. And that feeling good is based on that sense of identity that's being created. Okay, they see me the same way I am. Okay, so the notion of identity for Erickson is a notion of enduring sameness. You are the same across those situations. And it's constructed by looking at the transactions that you have with different people. Peers and parents and teachers and bosses. By looking at the bodily changes. You're looking at sameness across time. I already said this. So across situations, across roles, and inside and out. Now, how does this lead to integrity or your identity? It's the integrity that comes and the sense of identity accompanying it that comes from talking the same talk and walking the walk in different situations. So adolescents begin to experience the hypocrisy that we all manifest at times of being in the locker room and talking with your buddies about females in a way that objectifies them and is pretty sexist. And then having a conversation with your female friends about being a feminist and believing that women should be treated as equals and not as sexual objects, and sharing their concern about the way society treats them. And as an adolescent, you can see that you are behaving differently in different situations. That's non-isomorphism. Putting together, for example, the fact that somebody says something about racism to you and you don't want to be racist. You want everybody to be treated equally. So you profess that and you agree in those situations. And then you get into another situation where somebody says something that's racist and you don't do anything. You go along, you laugh at the joke, whatever it is. And as an adolescent, you think about those and you realize that's non-isomorphic and it's not acceptable. And it leads to the sense of diffusion. Who am I? Am I a racist? Am I not? Am I a sexist? Am I not? Where am I? In the process of doing that, you're creating a set of values. And then the task through adolescence and into adulthood is to live those values. And those, for Erickson, are the big challenges. Find the sense of identity, create a set of values, and then live by those, live with that identity, find ways to apply it in the world, and then carry it into your adult relationships. Along the way, some of the problems are just the sense of diffusion, which is fairly common. The process of experimenting with different roles. How do you create a sense of identity? For Erickson, you do that by trying all different kinds of transactions, different ways of being in relationships, different ways of being a student, different ways of working in the world, different sets of values. You try them out and you assess what happened. It's important in his view that it be experiments with roles. Adolescents, he said, should have, he calls a moratorium, so that you can try out all different kinds of things without getting stuck. A moratorium is a period during which you don't do anything that is binding, that's permanent. Okay, so you don't make changes that are permanent. And during a period of moratorium, you have the opportunity to explore. The important thing as adolescents are exploring is that they be allowed to experiment in the sense that you try something, and in an experiment, you assess the outcome, and then you quit. You move on, and you're permitted to leave the experiment. You learn something from it. So it's important, he said, for parents and others to know that adolescents need to experiment. They need to try out different things, but they need not to get stuck in those experiments. So, you know, you remember you wanted to play trumpet, right? Seventh, eighth grade, maybe ninth grade, you wanted to play trumpet. So you rented a trumpet, you took trumpet lessons, and your parents nagged you to practice, and you didn't because the trumpet didn't really fit very well. And your parents said, you start something, you have to finish it, right? You have to stick with it for the rest of your life because we rented this trumpet for you. And the important thing in Erickson's view is that parents be aware that kids experiment. Being a trumpeter is an experiment for most of us. It's not going to be a successful experiment. And we decide we don't like it. We don't practice. We don't want to do it. We would like to do it without the work. That's not going to happen for most of us. So we want to stop. We've learned from the experiment. It's not us. We have to fight our parents to get out of the experiment. Good parenting, he said, is, okay, let's see what we learned. What can we apply next time? We're not going to guilt trip you about the fact that we rented this trumpet for a year. You tried it. It's important to learn something from it. And then you can move on. With all of the different experiments that we do, so we need to learn something. And the role of adults and our peers is to help us sort out what we learned. Okay, so you tried the black leather jacket. You tried being a tough guy. You tried not doing your homework. How did that feel? We're not going to come down hard on you, but how did it feel to flunk the course because you were busy being a biker? Okay. Does it fit you? As your parent, I think it doesn't. You know, I think you have different standards for yourself. But it was an experiment. What happens, he said, very often is that kids get stuck either in a negative identity, the biker one, because the parents make such a big deal out of it and you don't want them to be right, so you get stuck in the negative identity. You carry it on too far, too long, and you can't get out of it. Parents who insist that they know exactly what is right for you run the risk of pushing their kids into doing the opposite. Another problem is foreclosure, choosing an identity and committing to it without really experimenting. Now, having a baby at 13 cuts off some experimentation if you choose to parent. Deciding you're going to be a nurse when you're 7 and never questioning that decision is a kind of foreclosure. If you never experiment with anything else, what happens is you get far enough along in nursing school and it's not fitting, so you're having some identity diffusion, you've already made all these commitments. How do you back out of the major that your parents sent you to UVM for? I'm picking on nurses because I love you. I love the nursing students. But I also have been talking to several recently who are in that process. My local example was a college friend who was going to be a doctor from the time he was 5. His father was a doctor, his uncle was a doctor, his mother was a nurse. Somebody asked him when he was 5, what are you going to be when you grow up? And he said, I'm going to be a doctor. That worked. Everybody knew what to give him. You know, stethoscope, doctor kits, you know, white coat. He knew what to do in high school. Study your butt off so you can get into a good college, so you can get into a good medical school. He figured out how to do that. It tells you what to do with your spare time. You volunteer at the hospital in high school, and you apply to Harvard pre-med, and you get in, and you do it. And what happened was that he never did anything else. And a foreclosed identity keeps you from having the anxiety that comes along from having to experiment. He didn't have to. He knew exactly what he wanted to do. And there were times, sophomore and junior year, when I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I really admired the fact that he'd known since he was 5. And he finished and got into Harvard Medical School in the middle of his second year. Ended up in the emergency room from swallowing a whole bunch of pills in a plea for help. He had experienced considerable identity crisis as he figured out, you know, I've never done anything else but doctoring. I've never been anything but pre-med from the time I was 5. And he began to question whether it was the right thing for him to do. His concern was that he couldn't talk to anybody about it because he had never expressed any doubt. He'd always been certain. That's foreclosure. When you're always certain about something and have never really questioned it, it's probably not valid. So, for him, for Bill, medical school, he eventually did his questioning. He said, help! And he took a bunch of pills that he knew wouldn't kill him. He ended up in the hospital. They called his father. His father flew to Boston. His father was there when he woke up. He was scared to death of what his father would think of him. And his father said, about time. Bill said, what? He said, I've been trying to get you to think about what you were doing for the last 7 or 8 years. Remember? Oh. Remember, I wanted you to take a year off before you went to medical. I suggested you go to Europe. I suggested you take more literature courses. Remember? Oh. Yeah. Well, I guess, you know. What happens with a foreclosed identity is that you don't hear anything that's inconsistent with it because you're not open to thinking about it. So he had shut himself off from all of that. So he took a few months off, went to Europe, studied philosophy, wrote poetry, went back to medical school. He's a very happy surgeon who writes poetry. Yeah. But he had his identity crisis in a really dramatic way and discovered that he had a foreclosed identity. He made it. And where you want to go eventually is to a sense of who you are. How do you get there? Well, an identity is formed by trying all different kinds of things and figuring out what you are and what you aren't. I love the metaphor. A great sculptor, at the unveiling of one of his magnificent horses with a rider on it, you know, one of those 12-foot marble things that they put in Washington, sculptor was asked, "How do you do that?" by a naive reporter. And the sculptor said, "It's really quite simple. You take a very, very large block of marble and a chisel and a mallet, and you cut away everything that doesn't look like a horse. And what's left is a statue of a horse." What you're doing in creating an identity is trying on things that don't fit and then chipping them away. Saying, well, I'm not that, I'm not that, I'm not that. I am this, this, and this, and that gives you a sense of identity. The important piece for Erickson is that the sense of identity is constructed from among options, not laid on you by other people, not chosen when you didn't have a choice, but it's constructed from options. It's a choice, and you know that you've made it, and that gives you the sense of security about it. After you have done that, after you've created a sense of identity, then you can go into relationships in late adolescence, youth, early adulthood. You can take that identity into an intimate relationship and add the role of being in a relationship to it. Wednesday I talked about the fact that a sense of intimacy is created by sharing an identity with another person, merging your identity to a degree, not entirely, but merging your identity to a degree so that being in the relationship is part of your identity. You've taken on that experiment, you've taken on that role of being a partner, and that becomes part of your identity. And people do that to different degrees. Some people make being a partner the whole identity, or as much of it as they possibly can, and others make being a partner a very small part of their identity. Different strokes for different folks. What you want to make sure, from an Ericksonian perspective, what you want to make sure is that you have your own identity, you know who you are, before you commit it to being a partner with somebody else. Now, having intimate relationships and being in a relationship can be part of the experimentation. You change your identity as you have relationships with other people. That's an important part of the constructive process, because other people give you feedback about what kind of person you are. And you may decide, I'm not going to be the kind of person who can get along with this idiot that I'm partnered with. So you develop a new level of autonomy, so you can commit yourself to a relationship with somebody who is actually healthy for you to be in a relationship with. Somebody who supports your identity, who isn't trying to change you, but who is willing to let you change yourself as you experience the relationship. And you might have heard an echo of Bowen and attachment, secure attachment, back there. So that you have the ability to go into a relationship and be secure, but not dependent on the other person to be your reason for being. You are your own reason for being. You have your own autonomous, self-constructed identity, which you then will share with the other person. If that person chooses not to do it, so be it. That's his or her choice. It's not a reflection of you. One of the elaborations of Erickson that I like is by a guy who's also not talked about in the text. This happens all the time. The guy named Kenneth Keniston. It just says Keniston there, but his first name is Kenneth Keniston. Kenny Keniston, he was called. Keniston studied with Erickson and worked also in college settings and studied graduate students and other people who were not quite adults but not quite adolescents anymore. And Keniston came up many years ago with a description of some of you. And I find this a useful kind of description, as he added a stage, which he called youth, to the lifespan. It's not a necessary stage, kind of optional, and it's not universally accepted by everybody, although there is a, quite recently there's been a major emphasis in the field of human development on what is now called emerging adulthood. But what they're referring to, what they're describing, is what Keniston described as youth. And the way Keniston describes youth is that during adolescence, we're working on an identity, and we're separating from family, and we're entering intimate relationships. We're trying those out. That's during adolescence. In youth, we take each of those a step further, and we figure out where we're going to use the identity. Here I am. I've got this identity. I know what kind of person I am. I've got a pretty good self-concept, pretty valid self-concept. Now, where do I find a place to put that in society? As a nurse, as a human developer, as a teacher, which of those or many of the other options for making a living and being an adult in the society, which of those will allow me to be the kind of person that I am? So I'm looking for a place to apply myself, to use the identity. In youth, I'm creating a new relationship with my family, not based on being separate from them, but being with them in a different way, so that they are accepting me as an adult. They are accepting the fact that I am a separate person. I have my own directions. I have my own relationships. I'm going to have my own place in society. So I'm finding a new way to relate to them, having established my autonomy or my separateness from them. And in the intimate relationships and in other parts of my life, I'm beginning to explore making real commitments. Not, I'll wear your ring and go to the prom with you, and we'll be together as long as we both choose to be, and I don't find anybody better than you. But I'm in fact making commitments, wary ones, he says. Not solid commitments, but wary attempts to be committed to relationships. For example, I want to have a relationship with you. I will wear your ring. Well, no, I won't wear your ring. Engagement, yes. Wedding, no. And I will stick with you even when we both have the flu. Or when you don't do what I want you to do, we'll work those things out. Because I'm committed to finding a relationship in which I can apply my identity. So the identity is being used in relationships as well. So these are the characteristics that he describes more broadly for this stage. You've got the sense of identity. That's come along. And you have a sense that it's not quite finished. He called it omnipotentiality. Anything is still possible. So in youth, there's a sense that you know who you are, but you can still change that. You still procrastinate, right? You know you procrastinate. And in youth, you figure that you can change that. Yes. Yes. It's clearly not childhood. It's, in his view, in Keniston's view, it's beyond adolescence, but it's not quite adulthood. So what some of the folks now, as I said, are calling, well, it's emerging adulthood. It's this midway, this transition period. And it's roughly the college years and maybe a little bit beyond. But not everybody goes through it. Some people graduate from high school, they've made commitments, they have jobs, there's no exploration going on, they're solidly adult, and you're probably not among them. There's concern for your own development and the development of others, particularly partners. That leads to an interesting difference. Someday I'm going to do a book about breaking up. Breaking up is hard to do. Breaking up is fascinating. Doing it badly, doing it messily, doing it dangerously, doing it well. Adolescents break up for very simple, typically, identity reasons. I don't like you anymore. Or, I found somebody I like better. Or, you didn't treat me right. The very straightforward, very simple, almost concrete reasons for breaking up when you're an adolescent. And it tends to get done messily. In youth, you get a new twist. I think we need to stop seeing each other because this relationship isn't good for you. It's hindering your development. How can you argue? How can you be upset with somebody who breaks up with you for your own good? Right? You've all heard that one. I love it. Youth is an advantage. It's an advance. And it's based on that development of other people. You're interested in children and how they develop. You get interested in how your parents developed. Were they really young ones? How have they developed? Especially if you're in human development. And your partner. How is your partner developing? New relationships with the family of origin. Ambivalence about the society. Remember that you're trying to find a place to put your identity in society, and now you're beginning to understand that society is not perfect. In fact, it's far from perfect. Maybe you don't even want to be part of it, but that seems to be the next challenge. People say, well, how are you going to pay your rent? How are you going to be in the society? So you've got to find a way to put yourself into the society in some reasonable way. But that causes us to question the society itself. So there's a lot of concern about improving society as we develop ourselves and other people in our relationships. There's concern about loss of autonomy, being socialized, having to do things that you would rather not do. Back in the old days, IBM used to require everybody who worked there to wear a white shirt and tie. Not a striped shirt, not a colored shirt, a white shirt, above the, at the managerial level and up. And when I first came to Vermont, I would hear people say, well, I'm getting a degree in engineering, but I'm not going to work at IBM because I refuse to be told what to wear. So they didn't, and they didn't make much money, but they didn't work for IBM. That's being socialized. Another example I love is a student several years ago who's still here in Vermont working, graduated, went off to Wall Street, got a job in a brokerage house selling stock. First day was great, doing all of his orientation. His manager took him out to lunch. After lunch, that great lunch, one of those nice expensive lunches that managers get to buy for their employees, and was filling him in on the company. And on the way back to the office, they stopped by a men's store in New York City. And he said, come on in, I want to show you something. And he took him in, and he showed him a table of neckties. And Eric thought he had dressed really well for being a businessman in Wall Street at 22. And his manager said, "See those? Those are all perfectly fine." That, the one he was wearing. No. Not at whatever the name of the company was. Take it off. He bought him a tie to wear back to the office. He said, "That one you can wear on the weekends. Nice tie, but not at..." That's being socialized, being told what kind of tie you can wear. I thought that kind of stuff was dead, but it appears it's not yet. Eric now has a job where he never has to wear a tie, ever. I saw him in November, asked him, "Got any good ties?" He said his wife gave him one a couple of years ago, but he hasn't worn it yet. All right. Wary commitments. I want to be able to be mobile. I don't want to get tied down. I need my autonomy, but I need connection and intimacy. How do I do that? Well, I'm willing to live off campus in an apartment for a year, commit to the rest of you, but I would rather that somebody else put their name on the lease so that I can get out of it. I'm willing to live with you, but we shouldn't get married yet until we figure out whether this is really going to work. Those are wary commitments. I'll live with you. I'll be faithful to you. I'll be monogamous with you, but I won't marry you yet. That would be a step too far. The desire for mobility, I love. How many of you could take everything you own and put it in an SUV and move to Seattle? How many of you would have to have a sale before you got it in? I used to use Volkswagen van because that's what we all had, buses. You know. Can you put everything you own in a microbus? Sure. Right. If you can, you're mobile, especially if you don't have a mortgage, especially if you don't have kids in school. The dog, maybe you could find a good home for it. Right? Mobility is important. So, for Keniston, we have adolescence, which most of you, I suspect, would be happy to have behind you. Are you ready to be adults? Keniston gives you this wonderful transitional option. I can do my exploration. I can work on commitments in society.
What if, let's say that one of our friends now got married, and so they kind of skipped over a lot of these.
Yeah.
Way in the future ended up, getting divorced. Is it common for you to see, wary commitments and, a lot of these tied in that they kind of had to be forced to skip over because of the choice they made when they were continuing?
Yes. The question, I'm going to phrase it generally, is what happens with people who are making commitments that are premature? And Keniston argues that in a very complicated society that we have, with the difficulty that we have in creating a sense of identity and making the choices, we are often reluctant. And appropriately reluctant to make commitments, but sometimes we get ourselves in situations where if we're really going to carry out our identity and we've made these wary commitments, we kind of have to live up to them. Like, we get pregnant. We're living together, we get pregnant. And we have been saying for 5 years we don't believe abortion is an option for me. Maybe for everybody else, but it's not an option for me. So there you are. Your partner's pregnant, you make a commitment. And that commitment may or may not be consistent with your identity, which is still in the process of being formed, and it may not last. It may not work. So Keniston says there comes a point when maybe you need to say this is not a permanent commitment. Maybe I need to be upfront and honest about that. Even if it makes me a bad partner from my partner's point of view. If I know myself well enough and have a sense of identity, then I'm more comfortable saying, you may not be the one And I may not be the one for you. That's okay. Let's try. Let's see what happens. But let's make sure the contraception works. Or be celibate while we live together. That's another option. Just wanted to throw it out there. It must be for somebody. Okay. So think about yourself. The question is, are you an adolescent or are you a youth? What Tennyson didn't do was describe adulthood. So I'll add that briefly. Sense of identity is achieved. You've found a place to put it to good use in society when you're an adult. You know the omnipotentiality is gone. Remember procrastination? Right. Those of you who know you procrastinate have a good sense of identity. Those of you who think you will get over it someday, if you can just find the right way to get over it, are still youth. Omnipotentiality reigns. Right? You can get over this. When you become an adult, you realize that anybody who doesn't procrastinate is probably sick. All normal people, procrastinate. And it's never going to change. The world is full of people who procrastinate. There are a few obsessive compulsives who are very nice people who never procrastinate. They're also not very creative, and you can't stand them, and you don't want to be married to one of them because they'll make you feel inferior the rest of your life. So beware of somebody who doesn't procrastinate. Now, what does that do for you when you're an adult? It means that you just assume everybody's going to procrastinate, so you accommodate it. You set deadlines a week before the real deadline. You tell somebody, sure, I'll write you a letter of recommendation. Just be sure to call me and remind me when it's due, because if you don't, I won't do it. So you give away the responsibility. It's your fault. You don't call me. If you procrastinate on calling me, you didn't remind me to write your letter of recommendation. I didn't do it. It's not my fault because you didn't remind me because you procrastinated. Well, society has its warts, but it's what we've got, so we're going to live with it and improve it from within. You already have been socialized. Good luck not being socialized. Family of origin continues to change. You can maintain your development, your interest in development of self and other people. In fact, you may be forced to do that as you become responsible for other people. The commitments are real. You can't get out of them. The bank I'm committed to, they actually loaned me money when I refinanced my mortgage. They're expecting me to live to be 88 and to continue to pay them. So I will never be out of debt. Oh well. It's a real commitment. I'm happily committed to my wife. Children, grandchildren, there you are. Job, I haven't changed jobs in 35 years. Mobility, I am where I am and I'm not leaving. I'm not going to pack up again. I'm never going to unpack the boxes in the basement. Somebody else gets those. I'm here. I'm not going to move again. I don't want to be mobile. It won't go in two moving vans. The garage is packed full. And I have a place to be in society. And that's a comfortable place to be in society. So the adulthood part is most of what is in process during youth has been resolved, but if you're lucky and work at it, you can keep the interest in change, the interest in other people, the interest in changing society, and you can keep the ability to play. You can keep some of those youthful characteristics and still be an adult. And the healthiest of us manage to do that. Okay, development of identity continues. through adulthood. And there are multiple roles to keep putting together. And they can conflict with each other. Sometimes it's hard to say, okay, I'm going to be a really committed lawyer and be very successful in my practice and be a committed husband and spend enough time nurturing the relationship and paying attention to what my wife wants to do, and be a committed father who's there and present when his kids are going through important events and be there to nurture. Those may be quite incompatible roles. So adults are often trying to construct an identity and a set of roles that are doable and make sense. And often along the way, adults are cutting corners someplace, compromising someplace, figuring out that you can't really do everything that you would like to be able to do. And sometimes the roles that we fall into that we really don't choose are of necessity running the show. Even though we may not want them to, we may not have any choice about what we do. Okay. So we're struggling through adulthood to continue to maintain a sense of identity even as our roles change, our relationships change, we change. Many of the roles and responsibilities that we get, we don't choose. They're given to us. We don't have any choice about them. We're put in positions that are demanding that we might not have chosen. We have to do it. You may have this wonderful notion that when you become an adult, you will be in charge of what happens to you. Good luck. That's not the way adulthood works. Adulthood is a process of coping with the things that are done unto you. You think that adults have the ability to choose what they're going to do, to make the direction of their own lives, and it turns out, I'm sorry to burst the bubble, but it turns out that that's not the way it works. What happens is, as you start making commitments, those commitments come around full circle and bite you in the butt. They limit choices that you have. They present you with new opportunities that you didn't expect to have. They present you with challenges that you never would have predicted. You think, okay, I want to get married, I want to have two kids. There you go. So you have one kid, and then you have triplets. Now you're the parent of four. Two of them have special needs. You're now a special needs parent. And you will spend the rest of your life managing, instead of getting your kids through high school and kicking them out so you can have an empty nest and do everything you wanted to do. You discover, as friends of mine have, you've got a kid who's going to be dependent for the rest of your life, and you get to make sure that you are responsibly taking care of that child's needs as that child becomes 45 or 50 or 55 or 60. It's not something you ask for, but that's what adulthood is about. Or you have parents who become dependent on you. You don't expect that. You expect your parents they'll just be fine, right? And they will, assuming they die young. They won't bother you as you go through adulthood. But if they live long enough, they're likely to bother you. They're likely to become a challenge. They're likely to become a wonderful responsibility. They're likely to give you opportunities to learn things you never expected to learn, especially about your parents. But adulthood is learning those things and carrying out those responsibilities that you didn't ask for, but there they are. So we're constantly trying to keep that sense of identity. And along the way, we have midriff crises. Something's happening to him. He's putting on the weight. The advantage of being sick last week was that I lost 3 pounds. I feel better. Right? This one I like even better. I'm leaving you, Agnes. I've decided to roam the countryside delivering babies. It's just something I've got to do. This is Larry going through a midwife crisis. It would be funny even if it wasn't Larry. Okay. So Erickson gave us the notion of the midlife crisis. And some of you who have parents who've been acting as if they have some kind of midlife crisis. And what does that mean? What it means is that any time you feel like things aren't hanging together and you're not really living the identity that you have, your roles, your responsibilities are incompatible with the way you see yourself. Things have happened to you and you've gone along with them, and you eventually get to a point, sometimes, some of us, when there is a major non-isomorphism between who we really are, however we define that, and the life we're living. And that creates a sense of diffusion again. And that can make us anxious. It can lead to a sense of crisis. And we can either cope with that by changing life. It's hard to change yourself, but you can change life in little ways and do experimentation. Try on some new things. Try changing the responsibilities that you have. And if you're well put together as an adult, you deal with the identity problems, the diffusion, by making transitions. You say, okay, I don't like the job that I have gotten into. The company has changed. It doesn't fit me anymore. The responsibilities that I've been given aren't comfortable for me, so I'm going to make changes. Or you can deal with them badly. You can make it a crisis by saying, okay, I need to get out of my commitments, I need to quit my job, I need to grow a beard. I just learned that an acquaintance of mine who lost his job has, over the last month, shaved his head, started going to the... He had hair, so this significant change. He shaved his head, he's started going to the gym, toning up. I'm waiting for the earring to appear in one ear or the other. And he's looking for a job completely outside his field. I think it's a midlife crisis. I think it's an identity crisis. I think he got fired because he was having that diffusion and he wasn't doing the job particularly well, so he lost it. And now he's saying, okay, I'm going to go back to adolescence. I want to go find out what his wife thinks of this, because I have a suspicion that she may have problems with his dramatic and drastic explorations. Would I consider them identity changes or an addition? It depends on what you do with the rest of the identity. If you add a role, if you add a new hobby, which many of us get encouraged to do, then it can be an identity change. It's just, okay, I'm going to add something, I'm going to enrich my life, I'm going to explore some new things that I might want to do, some new pleasures. I'm going to perhaps replace some of the things that are most burdensome to me with something different. It's an identity crisis when I throw up my commitments and my responsibilities and don't make planful changes and abdicate my responsibilities, leave my family, tell my kids they have to leave college because I'm not going to pay tuition for them anymore because I'm quitting my job to become a monk or whatever. That's irresponsible. And adults who are well put together don't behave irresponsibly. Okay. I'm going to go back to this outline. As we look at adulthood, I see four major themes, and one is identity that we've been talking about. You're constantly going to be tinkering with that identity and trying to keep it together so that you have a sense of who you are. And your relationships and your responsibilities, the things that happen to you, may be consistent and help you do that. They may be a problem, and choices that you make may be either helpful or problematic. But you're going to go through identity shifts and construction the rest of your life. It didn't end in adolescence. Adolescence was when it hit its ascendancy or its first time importance, but that sets the stage then for identity shifts and negotiation through the rest of your life. The second major theme in adulthood is the relationship changes that go on as we change our relationships with our peers, our family of origin, our peers, perhaps find partners, change partners, contribute to the next generation, and move up as we're going along through life, which I can... life and relationships. Here's one way to think about it. Here's the lifespan, simplified. When you're born, you come in at the bottom, and there are all these people who are older than you. You know, parents, grandparents, maybe even great-grandparents. Some of you are fortunate. And you come into the world and you're a little baby, and all these people know you and take responsibility for you. And they look out for you. At least some of them do. And it's an interesting and temporary point in life, in your family and in society. There is this brief period of time when you are the newest person and everybody is older than you, more experienced than you, and taking care of you. And then you keep growing. And then somebody else comes in, baby brother, siblings. And eventually what happens is that you contribute to having people younger than you come in that you're responsible for. So you become one of these responsible people. And as you pass up through the lifespan, two things are happening. There are more and more people who were born after you, and so for all of them, as long as you live, you will know them their entire lives. But everybody who's older than you, you only met when you came in. They had a life before you. But all the people who are younger than you, you can know through their entire lives, at least until you die. The proportion of those two groups changes constantly. So as you get older, there are more and more people you're responsible for and whom you've known since they were born. And one of your responsibilities as you move up is to take care of them and make sure you know where they are and when their birthdays are and celebrate them and send them cards and remember them at important events. You're the kin keeper. The people who are oldest are the ones who remember most, and they are the kin keepers. And as you move up, you're going to be more and more responsible for other people, and on the other side of that, there are going to be fewer and fewer people who know you, who knew you when you were born. And you're going to move up until at some point you pop out of the universe. But there will be a point, and this changes your role. I have 2 minutes. I'm going to use it all. This changes your role in the family from being the one everybody is paying attention to and doesn't expect much responsibility from, to eventually having more and more people that you are responsible to and for, and you are the one who knows them. And that's part of the responsibility. And eventually, there will be, if you live long enough, there may be nobody who knew you when you were little, because those people are all gone. So part of going through the lifespan with your family is this constantly changing position within the family, this changing balance of who you're responsible to and who you're responsible for and who's responsible for you, until eventually you're the one who has more history than anybody else. And that's a very special position. But it's a little scary when you reach that point of being the oldest living person in your family, in your line. That's changing your role. You've got to put that into your identity. I'll stop there and we'll finish up the lifespan on Wednesday.